Cook up the special sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. This week, we resume our conversation with René Redzepi, chef owner of Noma in Copenhagen, which was named the best restaurant in the world 4 years ago. Now, there's a new reimagined Noma.
We have 11 buildings on property. You know, there's a department for fermentation, a department for creativity, a department for forage foods, a department for daily mise en place, a department for service. And we have a sauna for the team, and it's pretty amazing.
And there's a new book, too, that he and his fermentation lab director, David Zilber, have just published, called The Noma Guide to Fermentation. Where we left off in our conversation, we just learned that René's becoming a chef was a matter of chance. In high school, there happened to be a cooking competition, and out of the blue, at age 15, when the high school really didn't want him back there anymore, he discovered he cared intensely about how everything looked on the plate and tasted. So you're 15, mm-hmm. You're cooking, you discover, hey, this is cool, mm-hmm. You're asking questions that probably not a lot of 15-year-old inexperienced cooks are asking. And 10 years later, you open Noma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot must have happened in those 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Many hours of work. I mean, when you at that time, 25 years ago, the restaurant industry was, you know, a crazy place to be in. And so I went out and I found myself a place to be an apprentice. It was a French restaurant, very classically set up. The chef in the back and the wife in the front. Small team, both places, front and back of the house. And the chef taking care of everything, me as their apprentice. And I spent 4 years with him. And it was an incredible time. I mean, I basically went from being a child to being an adult, like overnight. Just like that, you're working 85-hour weeks. And with responsibilities. And me and him, we really hit up. His name was Philippe Houdet. And he was an incredible cook. And within a couple of years, we had become friends. And I was like a trusted member of the team. And he would even ask me sometimes. I'll never forget the time that he asked me, can you do a dessert? We have some regulars. And you can do whatever you want, but you have to be wild, he told me. This was like 3 years in of my tenure there. And so I did this caramelized endive in like a spicy caramel with some sort of ice cream, a lemon ice cream actually. And it was completely wild at the time to use vegetables like that into a dessert. And he loved it. and it went on for the evening, for the regulars. And I still thank him so much, you know, in my mind when I think back to these moments that makes you and that gives you the courage and the power to believe in yourself further on. And those are the moments where you're actually fueled. You don't really realize it, but it helps you further on, you know, that at that moment when you're moving and growing up, somebody really believes in you and gives you the opportunity like that. So that was a pretty incredible moment for me. And then as my time was finishing there in Denmark, when you become a cook, you don't go to school. At least you didn't back then. You find yourself an apprenticeship. And so my apprenticeship, I became a chef with him. And then after that, of course, you were on your way to France. That's what everyone was
sure,
doing.
That was the standard.
It was standard. And he sent out my letter back then you faxed things.
Sure.
And we faxed them to all the 3 stars in the south of France. And I remember Philippe saying, you know what, we're going to fax it to this restaurant in Montpellier, but we're not going to hear anything because they just got 3 stars. So that's impossible. And then within like 5 minutes, a fax comes back and it just said, c'est bon, Jacques, which means, okay. And then signed by the head chef.
So you went there.
So I went there. And when I was there and it was summer and some vacation was coming up, and I read in a French magazine about a restaurant across the border in Spain that was supposed to be super wild. And it sounded really intriguing. So I asked the chef to book a table. And he's like, where did you hear about this restaurant? Because that happens to be my favorite restaurant in the entire world. I'll book you the table. I think this you should really go. And so I went, and I didn't know that El Bulli was to be, you know, the restaurant that right. That the phenomenon.
Became, right.
And I was there, and there was like two other tables in the restaurant. I was with a friend, and Ferran was there. We ate, and it was just mind-blowing to me at the time. So different to anything. I thought everything was French food. And suddenly you see yourself in Spain, and it's like, I cannot believe what's going on here. What is this? It broke everything for me. And so I went up to Ferran immediately after the meal and said, I want to work here. Can I come and work here? And he said, ah, it's difficult, but send a letter. So I did. I sent a letter. I went back to France. Immediately sent a letter. And about a month later, a signed contract came in the mail. Full contract with the starting date. And, you know,
this is a crazy story,
and I was accepted for the next season. Yeah, it was like that. And then following season, I went there. You know, it was like mind-blowing. By that time, in that year, something really happened to El Bulli. It was in 99. And it was really starting to happen for El Bulli. And so you felt part of something truly special.
Yeah.
You know when you're on the plane and the stewardesses, they have sat down and it's like, you know that you're going to go up now. That's how it felt working there. You were on the up. And I thought, wow, this is so crazy. I almost stayed there. So another lucky chance happened. Sort of halfway in the season, this very pale, very shy person walks in through the kitchen doors. And you could see that he doesn't speak a word of Spanish or French. So I go up to greet him. And he's American. And his name is Grant Atkins. And he's the sous chef at the French Laundry. Today he has a linea, of course. And I had never really heard about it, but, you know, welcome, welcome. How can I do something? So we kind of hooked up for the time that he was there. And then I got a book as a present, The French Laundry Cookbook. And I was flicking through the pages of this book, and it was like, again, I was actually really mind blown seeing the French Laundry Cookbook. It was so different. There was all these American pop culture references there, coffee and donuts, and really super inspired. The season finishes. I email Grant, can you get me in? He got me in. This was an internship at the French Laundry. And I arrived in San Francisco. I took the Greyhound to Yountville. And I stayed at something that was called the Pink Palace, which is a tiny little, can I say shithole on the podcast?
Yes, you can. it's an appropriate.
Yeah, a tiny little shithole of an apartment. And then, you know, 2-3 days later, we're supposed to go and have my first day at the French Laundry. And it was such a culture shock to me. You know, in Copenhagen, we bike everywhere. And this was like, their apartment was like 700 meters from the French Laundry. Yet we drove there in cars. And we would pass the French Laundry with 300 meters to be at the parking lot and then walk back, you know? But still, it was another of these outrageous experiences. You know, you were so lucky to be at a restaurant that is really changing the game. And that, and again, you felt you're on the up, you know?
Yeah.
You're on the plane, and this is about to take off.
It's like you're a frog that was going from lily pad to lily pad. But each lily pad was higher and higher on the food chain.
Yeah. And you felt that. I mean, honestly, you felt that. And so I finished my time there, and by this time, when I came back home to Denmark, it was very unusual for chefs to travel like that. So I was getting many offers. It's a small, tiny place, Copenhagen. And I ended up taking a sous chef for 3 years at a classic restaurant, but I thought it was good for me to
right.
learn how to maybe lead. And then at a certain point, I started getting offers to be head chefs and to be owner and, do you want to take over this place and that place? And then Noma came up, and I went to visit the space, and I fell in love with the space. That's why I ended up opening Noma, was because of this space. And that's 15 years ago. Amazing. And in between those 15 years, you know, a lot of things happened too. Like, I have three daughters, and I met my wife at the restaurant, actually, 13 and a half years ago. And now we have a book on fermentation.
Yeah, and now you have a book on fermentation, and you have a new reimagined Noma.
Yeah.
Where I presume there are things there that you wouldn't have imagined being possible, right? When, you know, when you first, even with the old NOMA, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is quite a leap for you.
It's a big one. I mean, we're in this now, and this is a, this is the property, you know, it's like a property. And it's a place that's been hand-built from the ground up. There are 11 buildings. Some of them are tiny, but we have 11 buildings on property. You know, there's a department for fermentation, a department for creativity, a department for forage foods, a department for daily mise en place, a department for service. And
these are
we even have a
you...
workout area, and we have a sauna for the team. And I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And I assume these, some of these things are things you learned at El Bulli, and some of them
it's a mix
just,
of everything,
yeah.
Of your background, of my travels, of what you learned at all the different places you worked at. It becomes you, and then somehow all of this gets distilled into your own experiences, you know, and hopefully you take the good bits,
yeah.
And not the bad bits, because in any experience there's also, you know, bad moments.
Yeah, but you're I get the feeling that you are a searcher, that this is that NOMA today, the reimagined NOMA, is not going to be similar to the NOMA in 5 years.
Probably not.
I would say that's a, probably a safe bet.
Probably not.
And how did you gain the leadership skills? Like, did was it just something that you found out you had?
No,
or did you...
No. Are you kidding me? I spent years being an outrageously bad leader. I mean, I remember when I was a cook and when I was a sous chef, I would always look at the, when I was a cook, it was the sous chef and the head chef. When I was a sous chef, it was only the head chef. I always look at them and say, why are they freaking out? I mean, can't they see they're doing no good? And then I became a head chef myself.
Were you a screamer?
I was a screamer for many years. I was,
wow.
Yeah. I just didn't know how to handle things. You become so thin-skinned that the smallest problems become disastrous. And then until a certain point where you're like, what am I doing? You're going to work and you're not even happy.
Right,
you go to work
screaming.
And you're angry. What's the point? And then you try, at least that's what I did, try to figure out what is it that made you come here to this place? Why is it so, why is it like this? And then slowly but surely I tried to take away the problems that made me angry. And today I'm not angry anymore. It's been a while since I've been a shouter. And one of the things that really made a huge difference was when you actually start delegating in a big way, like actually trusting people and letting them do their job. And letting them do their job means that you also have a very clear idea of what the job is that you want them to do. And you tell them beforehand, this is what I expect of you, and but you also leave space for them to fill in the role themselves and make it better, because that will happen.
Not that Receipts is NOMA, but I had to finally admit that I didn't know a lot of answers, and that it was okay to tell people that. And I think that's part of any sort of leadership narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you experienced that.
I experience this much more now where our restaurant is taken to a place that's better than I could have hoped for. And we have people in that different, fields in within our kitchen that are specialized, that are so much better at what they do than I am.
Right.
I'm still the one in the middle trying to make sense of it all. So that happens a lot now, and I think if I wouldn't have opened up to this, NOMA would have been much simpler, and we wouldn't have been here today in your studio in New York. Actually, I don't think so. It's become that because of all the other people. That's also one of the reasons why I'm so happy that this book is there's a co-author, which is a team member.
Yeah.
To really show that NOMA is so much more than, you know, me.
It's clear that it's not a cult of personality.
In cooking, that's how it often is. And I am very happy that that you know the publisher were brave enough, because frankly, I don't think many people would have, to say, okay, here's say, like a sous chef, and the sous chef has to be on all the book tour and be part of everything, and it's as much his book as it is mine. But this also to show that that you know it's impossible that to define Noma just by me. You may have started something, but what really made it great and where we are today is because of a lot of other people too. Yes.
I feel that way about Serious Eats.
Yeah,
you know, it's Serious Eats would be nowhere near what it became. It was a little $100 food blog. You know, when I started it in 2006, and now millions of people take pleasure from it, and it's launched
amazing.
Many, many careers and many best-selling books, and you know, the United States is filled with people that started at Serious Eats, and it, that gives you a unique pleasure, I think. And I don't know if you find that like with someone like David.
You
know,
yeah, it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, it's one of the great things about it. And you know, luckily we are in Copenhagen, in a place like New York where the competition is so fierce, but also there's so many people. So if you do well, there will be guests. Before, like 10, 15 years ago in Denmark, even if you did well, it wasn't guaranteed you were full because there weren't many guests. It's a tiny place. And so to have a moment now in which there are guests, people are traveling in, and if you do well, you will be full. That's a thing that people really still love. And I think all of us, we remember how it used to be. So we actually try to help each other and be supportive. There's no, I believe that what will potentially ruin the progress in our part of the world is if people start being sort of jealous of each other and entitled, then all the problems start happening, you know? So, but that's also one of the things one of the reasons why I think Noma's become what we are, because we were lucky to be in a small town where nothing was really happening. We were like the last stop on the subway, you know, culinary wise. And suddenly all this attention started happening, and everybody sort of chipped in. So while everyone's busy, it also helped Noma become who we are, because, you know, the community sort of embraced it.
It sounds to me like the first Noma was your idea of a idealized restaurant, but that the new Noma is almost like a fully realized village.
Well, yeah, almost. I mean, there's a reason why it's built like that. Because, you know, what if we want to change it into something in the future?
Do tell.
I can't.
You tell me, but you'd have to kill me?
No, it's not that. It's just, it's not 100% crystallized, but it's almost there. And I'm also somehow, this is my mother's doing, but I believe in, you know, if I say it, I've jinxed it.
You've jinxed
it. Yeah.
I know. So, all right. So now it's time for the special sauce, All You Can Answer Buffet. We've cut it down to a few questions just for you because you do have a plane to catch.
That's it.
So who was at your last supper? No family and no chefs allowed. Three people that you would love to break bread with.
Could it be like people that we don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let your imagination run wild. And I know you have a fertile one.
Oh, okay. Well, let's say Buddha.
Buddha. I like this.
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
And,
now you're cooking.
And the Prophet Muhammad.
That's so great. What are you eating at this amazing supper?
I will be having dinner in September.
Okay.
Because it's the moment where the forests are full of berries.
Okay.
Mushrooms are popping out. There's a little bit of game meat.
Okay.
But there's also crayfish and a mix of crayfish, wild game, mushrooms, and wild berries.
Ooh, I like this.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to ferment something.
I mean, it's the moment where everything is so fresh.
So you don't have to ferment.
No.
Yeah. So finally, it's just been declared Rene Redzepi Day all over the world. What's happening?
Everybody steps into nature.
Okay.
And they'll be guided, and then they have to eat minimum five things from the wild.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Rene Redzepi. If you're interested in thought-provoking writing about food, pick up a copy of the Fermentation Bible.
which you and your co-author David Silber, who couldn't be with us today, have done such a brilliant job writing. And if you ever find yourself in Copenhagen and it's worth a special trip, head to Noma. And if you do, poke your head into the fermentation lab, if Renee lets you. Anyway, so long, Serious Eaters. Thank you, Renee. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you next time, Serious Eaters.